Well, in some ways, this morning it feels like in the talkie bit we're exploring exploration. Not to get too caught in our own loop, but let's just see how it goes. The table, as most of you probably know, exists to provide room for exploration. And not exploration in general, although sometimes I think we get fairly general in our poking around, but in particular, exploration of what we believe. What is belief, anyway? That's a bit of a slippery idea. It can be hard to define. We know, for instance, that beliefs are not permanent. We can change what we believe. Sometimes we end up changing what we believe in ways that can feel like they happen to us instead of things that we choose or that we wish for or that we would prefer. It's an interesting thing, right? I mean, a classic example of that kind of an experience might be what's happening right now, where some cherished part of our worldview shifts because of a difficult or challenging or even tragic experience. So, for example, large numbers of people aren't in danger of dying of viruses in developed nations might have been part of what we believed about our life in this hemisphere at this time in this country and all of those things. And that might be an idea that's undergoing a bit of a shift these days. It's painful, right? That's a hard thing to go through. I didn't pick that example to foster fear. I picked it because it felt like one that we're all swimming in, that we're all surrounded by. I also picked it because it deals with some fairly basic, and I would say even primal, fears. Things like death, which is sort of one of our culture's remaining taboos, a thing that we don't tend to talk about. I mean, maybe if we deal with it all the time, we have more comfort with it. But in general, no, that's not something that we generally mess around with. A primal fear, or an elemental fear at least, like losing control. Again, with the luxury of living the way that we do these days in our culture, we have the illusion of a great deal of control over our circumstances. And when that illusion gets poked, gets jostled, sometimes our beliefs that underpin it, conscious or unconscious, change. When we engage in big, powerful things like that, things that are basic, primal, elemental in our lives and in our human experience, we need good tools. And when we do things like exploring what we believe, one of the most important tools in our toolbox is metaphor. Now, you did not show up this morning for a grammar lesson. Just the thought of that probably sends chills up and down a few of our spines. Not everyone loves grammar. I know this to be the case. I live with people who love it and are great at it, and I'm kind of intrigued by its meaning more than its detail, and so they're always helping me to try to fix my grammar. So I get that. But I'm going to keep this part brief. Stay with me. I'm going somewhere with this, okay? So if you're one of those people for whom that's a dreadful thought, don't skip this bit this morning. I'll keep it short. But a definition of metaphor. A metaphor is a figure of speech that makes an implicit, implied, or hidden comparison. Those are all important. Implicit, implied, or hidden comparison between two things that are unrelated, but which share some common characteristics. In other words, a resemblance of two contradictory or different objects is made based on a single or some common characteristics. Really important set of ideas in there. So, for example, if I say that in our household Tyrion is a night owl, we hopefully get it that Tyrion is not an actual owl, but that he shares some, not all, of the tendencies of that animal. So, for example, he would prefer to go to bed late and sleep in. But he can't turn his head all the way around, or see small objects in pitch dark, for instance. So that's a metaphor. Tyrion is a night owl. Okay? Now, for our purposes, when it comes to exploring what we believe, we're constantly trying to find words or ideas and words for ideas or experiences that are bigger than our language can embrace. So we're always trying to wrap language around things that won't sort of fit inside of it. And so we do this thing that we can do in that process, and we use metaphors. We compare our thoughts and experiences to things that they are not. That's important, but with which they share some common characteristics. Now, here's why I think that grammar business is worth a bit of our time. So let's cut right to an illustration that might have some, let's say, religious or spiritual weight, but religious first, I think, probably in most of our experiences. So, for example, when we talk about God as a father, which we might do if our God concepts have been shaped by traditional Christianity, we're not being literal. We're using a metaphor. We're saying that our concept of the divine includes some shared characteristics with a parent. Now, by saying that the way that I did the second time, when I said parent instead of father, and then moving on, I might be trying to duck one of the most easily seen and most often ignored limitations of that metaphor. It's gendered, right? And because it's gendered, because fathers are male figures, because it's gendered, it's vulnerable to being used as a basis for discriminatory ideas, for the justification of patriarchal ways of looking at the world, of patriarchal ways of acting in the world. And it leaves an awful lot of people out. It leaves an awful lot of people out of complementary ideas within the same tradition. So, for example, the idea that we're made in the image of God, you know, how does the gendered nature of God fit with that, right? And to kind of poke that one just a little bit more, the particular Christian sacred text that expands that idea into made in the image of God, male and female, goes on to say, created he them. And so we have at least two genders in that idea, but we still have the same problem, right? We still have, now we have a gender binary, which leaves out anyone who doesn't conform to that binary, and we still have a gendered metaphor for the divine, for creator. So we can see the problem, right? Metaphors can be super helpful. Sometimes they can feel like all that we've got to work with, and they are limited and limiting, and they routinely come up short. Now, in some ways, that might be frustrating. I mean, this is, if my claim has any merit, this is one of our significant tools for exploring what we believe. But if we are committed to exploring what we believe, and we think that's an intriguing endeavor, then that limitation of metaphor is not just frustrating, it's also exciting. I think one of the simplest ways to point out why it's exciting is to say that it keeps mystery alive and well. So, if we could find a metaphor that didn't fail, we wouldn't have a metaphor. We would have the thing we're trying to describe itself. Right? Language, including our language about spiritual things, isn't actually meant to exhaust what we're exploring. It's meant to point toward some aspect of it, some facet of it, to give us one more intriguing glimpse into the possibilities to keep us exploring. So the limitation is actually part of the beauty. A few years ago, our family had a chance to visit the Azores. That's a group of islands. They're part of Portugal officially, even though they're 1,300 kilometers from Portugal's coast. If you want the real goods about the Azores, ask Zeke. He's from there. I don't imagine this would ever happen, but in my dream world, I would get to go visit the Azores with Zeke. And I'm sure it would be an utterly different experience than the one that we had when we were there basically, you know, as tourists. Anyway, these islands have an incredibly temperate climate. It never gets terribly hot, and it never gets especially cold. If it gets anywhere near zero in the Azores, it's an event. So it's just this really moderate. And there's lots of rain. So together with all the precipitation and the temperate climate zone, there's a ton of fog. And almost all the pictures, though, that you see of the Azores, if you go look them up, don't do this right now, you'll miss the good part. Do whatever you want. But if you go look up the pictures of the Azores, almost all of them are sunny and incredibly beautiful. The place gets called things like, you know, Second Eden. They're incredibly gorgeous spaces in the sunshine. And there's this one especially picturesque hike where if you did go look up pictures of the Azores, this would probably be the first half dozen images you would see are of this hike. And it's sort of like a land bridge, this narrow land bridge that goes out to a viewpoint. And from that viewpoint, you can see several volcanic crater lakes and the surrounding vegetation, and so it's absolutely gorgeous. When we were visiting, of course, I mean, we wanted to see that view, right? So we kept on showing up at the hike into that viewpoint, and every time we went there, it was so socked in with fog that you could basically see a couple of fence posts ahead of you in the railing alongside this hike. I mean, sometimes you couldn't see the people you were hiking with, never mind this panoramic view. But we believed the view was there. We kept coming back. Now, after a few days of this and a few days on the islands, we started to get a little bit more savvy about how the fog moved around, which coasts were likely to be clear when, what the weather systems looked like when they were headed toward a break. Inland, all that kind of stuff. So despite the fact that on this particular day it was bucketing rain, we were like, nope, you know what, the forecast suggests this might be a good one, and we went back again. So got all geared up, hiked out there, soggy, foggy, no view of anything but fog. We hiked back, sat around in the parking lot for a while, rain, fog, no view, and then just when we were about ready to bail, sorry, that wasn't an intentional pun, but it was getting close to that. It kind of looked like it was lightening up. It was doing that thing it sometimes does before it breaks. And so we headed out on the hike again. And it wasn't like a two-minute hike. It's a bit of a walk in there. And we got all the way to the end, kind of maybe this is the time, and no view. It was foggy. And I've got a nice collection of pictures of us in the fog to prove it. So we kind of just let it go. It's like, you know what? Let's call it a wrap. And we hiked back toward the car. And then partway back, I don't remember who did this, but somebody was like, there's a break in the clouds, which at this point in the whole process sort of feels like somebody going, I just won the lottery. And so we all race back to the end of the hike, and sure enough, the clouds clear. We get our own version of this incredibly stunning view of this part of this one island, and that lasts about 5 minutes, and the fog's, you know, blows back in. And I gotta say, it was worth every minute of hiking in the rain. Now, Zeke, if that story feels like it sells the beauty of your home island short, let me just say that I would go back there in a minute. I would walk through the rain and the fog again. I would explore again, because the exploring that we did, trying to get a glimpse of that particular thing we were seeking, took us to so many incredible places, on so many good adventures, into nooks and crannies we might never have sought out if we could have gone straight to the thing itself. Metaphors and stories do that too. They take us on journeys that we might not go on if we could just sort of have the drive-up version of the view. In some ways, I think that spirituality and religion does this to spirituality, I think, sometimes. Spirituality that says, here's how it is, that's kind of like the drive-up view. We can just go look at the thing. We could say, yep, that's how it was described. That's how it was represented to me. Check it off the list, you know, been there, seen there, done that, got it, and move on. For us as a family, the Azores, as we just barely began to discover while we were there, is about a lot more than that viewpoint. And that's without ever having lived there or struggled there or invested our lives there. You could spend a lifetime exploring there, not despite the fact that they're more difficult to know than the website might suggest, but because they're more difficult to know. That's why you keep exploring. So our limited metaphors aren't a curse. They're what keep us exploring. Their limitations are what make the glimpses that we get so powerful, so intriguing, so motivating to carry on. And it's what should remind us, if we stand back and think about it a little bit, that should remind us to wield our chosen metaphors with some humility, with some caution, with some ongoing curiosity about what complementary or alternative metaphors might be. If we're exploring anything we think is ultimate in some way, and we're using the tools we have, this is the space that we're in. A particular reminder of some of these ideas that we're surrounded by all the time these days. We touched on this a couple of weeks ago, but I wanted to at least briefly revisit it in this context of considering the limitations of metaphors as well as the ways they keep moving us forward in our explorations. This pandemic and its related struggles are often being referred to by the metaphor of war. Now, does that metaphor illustrate some aspects of our experience in telling in important ways? Of course it does. That's one of the reasons why we're using it. It's a handle for a whole bunch of experiences we're having that we don't have adequate language for. But we do have this particular metaphor, and it touches on some aspects of dealing with a pandemic that have something in common with fighting a war. You remember that definition of metaphor that we had a few moments ago? Some aspects, maybe even sometimes a single aspect in common. Tyrion is a night owl, right? Now, what might some of those obvious points of connection be? Well, perhaps we feel like the commonalities with the thing we're using metaphorically, with war, they might include things like our understanding that this virus is deadly. Maybe it's that we feel beleaguered, as we might if we were, in fact, at war. When we feel that way, we tend to look for heroes. We find it deeply reassuring to imagine that there's a vanguard out there somewhere doing what we cannot do to provide protection and ultimately to preserve our cherished previous way of life. And the war metaphor provides some easily accessed imagery for things like that. But, as with any metaphor, this one has its limits, and it comes with its own baggage. I can recall where I was the first time I heard the language of war being used about this pandemic, and something inside of me kind of lurched a little bit, and there was an internal reaction that was different than the one that I was usually having of these daily, you know, broadcast updates that I was listening to when I heard it the first time. But at the moment, I just sort of sat that interior experience aside as being, you know, another aspect of the stress of the general situation. And then a couple of days later, I was having a conversation with our oldest, Davis, and Davis's theater work has had a strong focus on accessibility for everyone, whatever the reason for their being marginalized might be. And Davis pointed out how our metaphors carry things that we might not have intended or realized. And that made me reconsider that metaphor and re-examine some of what was going on inside of me when I heard it used. The metaphor of war can carry an idea like rally the troops really easily. It's sort of the low-hanging fruit when it comes to looking for language that might motivate people to act as we might choose to act if we were facing a common military threat to our existence. So sort of that band together part of things. Ideas like, together we're stronger than the enemy. We're big. We're powerful. We're scary. We're going to send this thing running. We're going to beat it. Wait a minute. We're going to beat it? You mean like an abuser beats an abused? You mean like the way a bully beats a bullied? Oh, no, we just meant the way the winning army beats the losing army. Where'd the violence come from? Where'd the violent imagery come from in dealing with a virus? Well, it's built into the metaphor. In war, there are winners and losers. In war, power is violent and vertical. There are the strong, there are the weak. There is us, there is them. We can kind of hear it, so this is all stuff that's carried by the metaphor. It might not be what we intended, but it comes along for the ride. We can kind of hear this sneaking in when we talk about people who've gotten sick from COVID. We use a phrase maybe like they couldn't fight it off, as though it was some sort of weakness of character or of insufficient strategic planning or something military. People who can die more readily, if we're living in this metaphoric idea, can... People who die can be more readily thought of as collateral damage. You know, the glory in this metaphor goes to the young, it goes to the strong, it goes to might. Standard protocols that are in place to protect the vulnerable can be more easily set aside, justified as necessary strategic initiatives to, you know, win the war against COVID. All we have to do to sort of see this in action from our vantage point historically is look critically at exploration of certain health issues or human conditions where the beings that were used, and I use that language advisedly, for the experiment would have been prisoners of war. In a metaphor of war, there are heroes and there are, well, you know, everybody else. Now, that last one's tricky, at least to me. Is being deeply appreciative of those providing care and essential services a good thing to do? Well, of course it is. That feels terribly obvious that we should be appreciative of that. And it can be done without creating a new category of persons that also marginalizes everybody that is not in that category. I mean, if we've got heroes taking care of our enemy for us, why should the rest of us actually take this seriously? I think this is part of the problem for those heedlessly swallowing the metaphor. We can sort of carry on because there are heroes who are doing the dirty work. That's what heroes are there for, right? Well, like I said, every metaphor fails somewhere. I'm not going to explore this today, but I want to introduce some other possible metaphors for what we're facing and how we might best respond without relying on the language of war. I'm just going to toss these out there for people to ruminate on. One possibility comes from the realm of people dealing with terminal illness. And some folks, of course, do choose those combative metaphors. I'm going to fight cancer and I'm going to beat it. And there are people, though, for whom that is not a life-giving metaphor, so to speak. And so lots of those folks would move to metaphors that think of healing as things like a journey or like a river rather than as a fight. And metaphors like river or journey can remind us of some important aspects of dealing with a time like this, one of which would be the significance of the passage of time. So it's not just a moment. It has a flow to it. It might also, the river metaphor might also remind us of the significance of the idea of following many parts, following a shared path, as a river does, and that some of the obstacles can be anticipated. For instance, we could explore the metaphoric language of an orchestra or of a symphony, the ideas of things like submission to a common score, mutual submission, agreeing that we're going to work together to achieve this common end, an idea like the importance of each one playing their own part and doing so in ways that harmonize and complement and hold up the other parts. And then here's one that I'm planning to explore in a little more detail in the weeks ahead. We might consider metaphors from the realm of ecology, ideas like ecospheres or biomes, of seeking balance not only in our natural world but also in our social and our cultural world, spheres in which imbalances may have and may continue to make us vulnerable to things like a viral pandemic. Now, that metaphor of an ecosystem, the metaphors that have to do with seeking balance, those feel to me like they have some unique potential when it comes to spiritual exploration as well. The idea that everything is connected, which is an idea you quickly bump into in exploring ecological metaphors, those ideas of the interconnectedness of things, often, if we examine them, they often have their roots in some kind of a spiritual binding story or meta-narrative that might choose to use God language in order to represent what things are bound together within. That's a bit of a complicated idea to just drop and move on, but in the traditions that many of us might be familiar with, God can represent sort of the ground of all being, for example, or that in which all things hold together, to use the language of the New Testament for it. Anyway, more on that another time. For now, what I'm going to do is I'm just going to leave that one hanging a bit so we can ruminate on other possible metaphors, because this is not exhaustive, what I'm doing this morning. Obviously, it's just more meant to, you know, do what we do, which is stir us up to keep exploring. It's meant to expose limitations and also possibilities. My hope is that when we do this kind of work, one of the results is that we end up with more than one tool in our toolbox. We don't end up, you know, treating every problem like it's a nail, because the only tool we've got is a hammer. And I think that can help us. That can help us in all kinds of ways. Now, so like I said, I'm going to leave that one there. But a couple of quick, I don't know, details, significant things that we look forward to. Next Sunday is Mother's Day. I hope that wasn't a surprise, but if it was, there you go. Next Sunday is Mother's Day. And motherhood, you know, it is and always will be a mystery to me. I think that's both obvious and as it should be. That said, mysteries are intriguing and they can draw us into things we need to learn. That's what we've been talking about for the last half an hour. So next Sunday, Judy is taking the talkie bit. Judy is many things as a person in our community and as a human being, and one of them is that she's a mother. And so, Judy, you'll have 30 minutes to explain the mystery. I look forward to the result. Actually, of course, I'm being silly. But I do look forward to what you have to share with the community next week in the talkie bit. And it clearly, you will not have a problem live streaming horizontal. So just that'll be refreshing. I look forward to whatever you have to bring, Judy. Very much. Now, last thing. If you're still with us, I would love to hear from the people that are part of the community of the table what sorts of things you think it might be interesting to explore in a season like this. We don't know when we'll be able to physically gather again. We're keeping a close eye on that as a leadership group, and we'll keep you posted when this becomes a possibility, in a reasonable way, then obviously we'll want to do that, right? We'll all be looking forward to it. But in the meantime, we're exploring this way. And one of the things that I would love to do is get some input from this community about what sorts of explorations you think might be interesting or potentially helpful for this community in this time. You can email me. You can find my email address on the website. You can post it here on the Facebook page. I'll keep an eye on that as well. And one way or another, I just love to get some of those ideas. And as when I usually do this, I typically end up with a bit of a list that I can mine for long time to come. So if you do contribute an idea and feel like you've been ignored, that's not the case. It just means it went into a larger kind of group of considerations, and you know, we'll get there. We'll poke around in it, whatever it is. All right. Peace to you all. It's been lovely to be with you. Not as lovely as being with you. But this is good too, and I'm grateful for it. All right. Peace, everybody. We'll see you next Sunday. Bye for now.